Good afternoon. I'm Sarah Brown, but I go by Sarah E. Brown because there's so many Sarah Browns out there. And the work that I do focuses on helping individuals get in touch with their unique personality and then translating that into job satisfaction and success and improving key relationships. I have a doctorate in a field called psychoeducational processes, and I've written several books on this topic. But the real background that prepared me for this work was 30 years of working in corporate America. And it was those 30 years that taught me two very valuable lessons about the way people learn. The most powerful way is through failures. Failures we survive, that is. There seems to be something about the pain of that experience that just puts a lesson in us that we don't forget. And that's one of the reasons that corporate training focuses on simulation, because you can get that experience of failing and the lesson that comes with it in an environment that's safe. Well, safe for the corporation, maybe not for you, but safe for the corporation. So that's one of the most powerful ways that we learn. The second way that we learn is through stories, the stories of others. And they're even more powerful if it's about their failure and how they survived, because then we don't have to live through it. So we're very, very blessed today that we've got two really interesting women who have charted different career paths and who are willing to share their stories with us so that we can learn from them. So I first got interested in this topic when I was managing director for Accenture. And for those of you who don't know, Accenture is a large consulting and outsourcing firm. And I was doing a lot of business process outsourcing work. And a lot of that focused in an area called talent management. And talent management is essentially the recruiting and hiring of people. It's training and developing them, and then it's doing performance management. And I observed, and I knew innately, that there was a real business cost if people were in the wrong job. If we made a bad hire, for example, and had to replace that person, the cost to us as Accenture and to our client could be anywhere from 1 to 10 times the salary of that person. So it was an expensive mistake if we made it. But one of the things that I also came to understand in my work was the personal cost of being in the wrong job. And I noticed that when I started observing so many of my clients who were in the wrong job, and they were miserable. Now, that should not have been a surprise to me, because Gallup, who I follow regularly, was reporting that over 70% of people in America are not engaged, meaning they're less than happy in their job. But even more importantly than that, there are mounds and mounds of studies that point to the fact that if you are unhappy in your job, it can have consequences in your physical health, in your mental health, and in other areas. In fact, one really interesting study that has just been released was done by Ohio State University, and it found that job satisfaction in your 20s and your 30s was positively correlated with your health in your 40s. So in other words, if you're unhappy that early in your career, it can play out in health consequences in your 40s, as late as 40, 20 years later. Now, the really interesting thing about that study is that it did not suggest that you have to get in the perfect job right out of school. What it said was is the important thing is that there is an increasing slope of satisfaction, that you're continually making improvements and increasing the satisfaction in your job. And if that were the case, it was positively correlated, meaning you were more likely to have better health in your 40s. So let's go back to my small client sample, for example. What I noticed about them that was really interesting is when they would tell me how unhappy they were at their job, I would then ask them, well, what do you want? And more often than not, they could not answer the question. They could not describe the ideal job for them. They couldn't even tell me, in many cases, what the next best step for them would be. And this question really, really bothered me. And so I started thinking a lot about it, and I had to ask myself the same question. And you know what I found out? I couldn't answer the question myself. There were things about my job that I loved. I was not unhappy. There were things that I didn't like, though. I loved my clients, but there was a whole lot of stuff that was keeping me in constant stress. So I figured, if I'm going to do anything, the first thing I've got to do is answer the question for myself. And I did that by taking a whole battery of personality assessments, and I got a coach. And I worked through what was unique about my personality and then began to make some subtle changes in my job to be more in line with what I was really interested in, what my natural strengths were, so I wasn't compensating for weaknesses, I was building on strengths, and the things that were causing me stress and how I could minimize that. Now, you'll find, in listening to the stories of these two women, that's not the only way to go about it. And so we're really blessed that we have two women that are going to tell us their stories and tell us about how they came to understand what was important to them and what their strengths were that they could build on. So let me introduce our panel now. Sitting to my right is Gina Clark. Gina is Executive Vice President and the Chief Marketing Officer, the CMO, for AmerisourceBergen. If you're not familiar with that, AmerisourceBergen is involved in almost every aspect of the pharmaceutical supply chain. They have over $135 billion of revenue. The CMO job is a big deal. But in addition to that, she's also the president of the AmerisourceBergen Foundation, their charitable 501c3. And she somehow finds time to do a whole bunch of stuff outside of work as well. She's on the National MS Society Board. She's on the CMO Forum Advisory Board and the Business of Personalized Medicine Summit Advisory Board. Do you see why she was named a 2015 Woman of Distinction by the Philadelphia Business Journal? This is Gina Clark. And sitting to my left is somebody who has chosen a very different career. This is Courtney Smith Goodrich. She is head of Technology Strategic Programs and Business Management at JP Morgan Chase in the financial sector. In contrast to Gina, she has been, except for a small interlude she'll tell you about, she's been at JP Morgan Chase almost her whole career. So she's going to offer an interesting contrast to Gina's story. Outside of her day-to-day activities, though, she's doing something that is very interesting and very near and dear to my heart. She sponsors the University Collaborations Program. This is working with select universities in the Delaware Valley and with some novel educational institutions to transform the way technologists are trained. For those of you who may not know much about Delaware, I'm from Delaware. We envision ourselves being a technology innovation hub. So the work that she is doing is critical to our economic development. This is Courtney. So to get us started, I want to reference an opinion piece that was written in the New York Times this past weekend by Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She's the Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. And she said that at least weekly, she has tours of students, school-age students, coming through the Supreme Court. And she said that the number one question that they are asked, and that she specifically is asked, is, did you always know you wanted to be a judge? Now, the interesting thing in this article is that she didn't answer that question. But what I thought was interesting was the fact that the question is on the minds of school-aged children. When and how do you know what you want to be? So So there are lots of cases of people that have known this. I profiled one in one of my books, Leanne Hansen. She's an Emmy and Peabody Award NPR journalist. And she was very clear at age 5 that what she wanted to do was to perform. That the word, the spoken word, and the performed word was important to her, and she knew it at age 5. There's a story about Micah Prajinsky, who is on MSNBC's Morning Joe. She said she too knew at about that age that this is what she wanted to do. But my research and my experience has been that's not usually the case. It usually happens about mid-career. For whatever reason, people get thrust into a change, or they get to a point and they begin to wonder, I wonder if this is all there is. I wonder if there's more for me. And then there's also the case, like me, of being the late bloomer, who didn't figure this out until 30 years into her career. So I'm going to ask each of the panelists to give us a snapshot of their career and to specifically answer the question, when and how did you know what you wanted in a career? Cheetah, you want to start?
I'm happy to, Sarah. My career beginnings were a little bit different. So if you don't know now, you'll know after I talk for a few minutes that I was raised in the South, and by very traditional parents, very loving, wonderful parents, who certainly encouraged me to get a wonderful education and to be very involved. But I wasn't necessarily encouraged to go after the big Fortune 100 corporate positions. There were lots of other careers for women that probably fit my parents' mold a little bit better for me. So I did go to college and I got a degree. Well, let me back up. What I wanted to do when I was 5 and 10 and 12 and 15 was to perform, to sing. I wanted to be a singer. I wanted to be Barbara Streisand or somebody in that ilk. I did figure out when I got to college that that was probably not in the cards for me. I still love music, and it's informed my life in a lot of ways, but I began to realize that as a career was tough. So following that traditional path, I got degrees in psychology and social work and went into not-for-profit work for a couple of years and then landed at a psychiatric hospital as a social worker. About 9 or 10 months into my tenure there, the administrator, we called them administrators at the time, called me in and he said, I've got bad news and I've got better news. And I was like, okay, this never sounds good when you're in the administrator's office. But he said, the bad news is you're not a great clinical social worker. And I actually knew that, so a little bit to Sarah's point, I knew I was not a great clinical social worker. I wasn't exactly sure what I was going to be great at. You know, I'd already had to take music off the list, so I had to like go to social work. So he said, I think I have a strong sense that you would actually do very well on the business side of healthcare. He said, you're a good communicator. I've watched you with associates and patients. He says, I think you'd be a great business person. So he said, if you'd like to do a one-year residency with me, you're not gonna make much money, but I'll teach you the business side of healthcare. So obviously I grabbed that opportunity since I didn't know what I wanted to do. And then about 6 months into that, I had my moment. It was all of a sudden like I thought, I've kind of come home. This, who would have guessed? I would not have guessed. I don't think my parents would have guessed that this ended up being a really great fit for me. I stayed at that hospital for several more years and headed up over time their business development, physician relations, different business functions. Moved to a larger med-surg hospital chain, did the same function there. Then I spent 8 years at a very fast-growing, for-profit corporate healthcare company where I was one of two women who made it into senior management in a very challenging environment, learning different aspects of the business world as I went, things that I remember the day that the CEO came into my office and said, I know you're doing the marketing and the PR. He said, there's this thing, we think it's a phase, it's not gonna last long, it's called managed care. He said, so if you could just like do a few of these managed care contracts off the side of your desk, that would be great. And I'm like, I can hardly read my insurance benefit statement. What do you mean? He said, it's nothing. And we don't think it'll last long, so just do it. Obviously, he was wrong. And I learned a whole lot about managed care and benefits and a lot of things that, quite frankly, informed my career. A couple of more career moves that were positive in nature, and I landed at the very wonderful company that I'm at now, AmerisourceBergen. And it's been a business journey, not very traditional. picking up pieces and parts. My job did, you know, pivot little bits. It was mostly in that marketing, business development, communication function, but with a few pivots. But I have never looked back. That moment in that administrator's office was truly transformational for me because I didn't know what I was going to do. And somebody else actually saw something in me that was infinitely helpful and helped get me on a great path.
So just a follow-up question. What do you specifically did that individual observe in you?
I think what he observed is, and I actually credit watching my dad to some degree for this. My father was a car salesman and eventually had his own car dealership. And I watched my dad work with people for years and kind of read people and understand them and know how to direct them through this big moment of buying your first car or buying your kid's car. And I think that what the administrator observed in me is somebody who also learned to read my audience and understand what they were doing. I mentioned that I was a singer. I think that he picked up that I connected with the audiences that I was talking to. It's really what marketing and sales is. It's understanding your audience and selling to what they need, selling what you have to what they need. So I believe that's what he saw.
Very cool. Courtney, same question.
So I have a younger sister and an older brother who I love dearly, both of whom knew exactly what they wanted to do when they were probably like fresh out of the womb. So my sister always wanted to be a vet. She's a vet. She's a fantastic vet. She's a great mom, all those great things. My brother, who's a mathematical and science genius, basically was only ever going to go into math and science because he called me in college and asked me how to spell what. And so we kind of knew that he wasn't going to do anything related to the language skills. So he's a fantastic engineer and technologist himself. Me, I was very different, as you said. I don't know that I still know exactly what I want to do, but this seems like it's in a pretty good place. So I started in college. I actually started as a political science major with the intention of, I want to be a lawyer. Why, by the way, I'm like if you go know Myers-Briggs, I'm an ISTJ. I sign up for these things because they sound like a great idea, and then last night, this morning, I want to throw up. but so why I wanted to be a lawyer, to like stand on stage all the time, I don't know. So I did that. I took my very first political science class with somebody who was very different of opinion than I am as an instructor, and that was that lasted about a semester before I said, let me go into business. To this day, I don't really know why I decided to major in business. I think maybe I had a friend who did it. So majored in business, and then about midway through my college career, I said, I really want to go into medicine. So too late to switch my major again. So I said, I'll declare two minors in bio and chem. So I did that, love my minors. By the way, it's very interesting taking accounting and organic chemistry at the same time. So I did that, I get into medical school, and I'd ridden on voluntary ambulances, had no issues with blood or whatever. Anybody has a problem here, you're in fairly good shape. So I was like, all right, I'm gonna go to medical school, get in. I have a massive panic attack around, somebody's actually probably gonna die, and it's probably gonna be my fault. And I'm the person, I'll tell you a different story. My daughter has that diabetic, and she had a diabetic issue a couple weeks ago, and I ran into Wawa, and there was a huge line to get her a soda, and I ran out, gave her the soda, and came back in to pay, and they were like, why are you paying for this? I'm like, because I just stole your soda. So you can imagine, somebody dying was weighing on me. I'm like, all right, so I probably really shouldn't go into medicine right now. So next best thing, I went to grad school to be actually very similar to what you described originally. All right, I will now go run the hospital. I'll learn about the business of running the hospital. And my parents were extremely generous, and they paid for our undergrad, and they said, you have to go to graduate school, but we're not going to pay for it. So I'm in graduate school. I need a job. So I went down to the Career Services Center, which at the time, I went to the University of Delaware, by the way, and at the time, it was, an old rickety house, and it was a little sheet of paper stuck up on the wall with little tabs. And those of you who are around my age know what I'm talking about. And it said, go work at J.P. Morgan as an intern. They pay 10 bucks an hour. And so back, by the way, in the, early 90s, 10 bucks an hour, and still is, by the way, I think, really good salary. So I was like, all right, so I take the tab off, I go interview. Whatever they read in my resume, they said, you would be great at technology. And I said, you are totally full of it, but it's $10 an hour, so I'll do it. So I start working there, and my very first job at J.P. Morgan was teaching people how to use a mouse. Does anybody care to raise your hand and tell me what's the best way to teach people how to use a mouse? Anybody know? Who said it? Over here. Yep, you teach them how to play solitaire. So by the way, I'm in grad school. I've got this job, $10 an hour, and I'm teaching people how to play solitaire all day long. So I'm like, this is like the best job ever. I don't even know why you consider this technology, but it sounds great. So I'm still loving my graduate school. I'm there, and in my job as an intern, though, I quickly moved on from solitaire. And moved into writing system documentation. And by the way, if you are writing system documentation today, then your developers are terrible because you should not need to do that these days. The system should be much more intuitively designed. Then I moved into what we call business analysis, which was essentially translating business requirements into the system functional requirements. And then I did testing of the system. And if anybody in the audience knows me for about 5 minutes, you know if I'm going to test it, I'm going to intentionally break it. And if it's functionally broken, I'll tell you. And if the font color is not the right type, I'm going to tell you that too. And so it was very quickly kind of a pain for the developers. And I would go over to tell them I found this was broken. And I would look over their shoulder. And as they're scanning through the code, I said, well, that's where it's broken. And very quickly they said, why don't we just teach you how to code? And again, I'm making $10 an hour, and it seemed like fine. I'm like, sure, I'll learn how to code. I loved it. It was not something back then, by the way. It was more or less social suicide to say you wanted to go into comp sci as a female. It wasn't even a discussion, frankly. It wasn't even like I chose not to do it. It was more of like it wasn't even really something you considered. And I've been doing it for now 23 years. I haven't coded that long, but when I have a really, really bad day at work, I want to go back and code in the worst way. The binary nature of that's pretty nice. But so basically, it was somewhat similar to Gina, right? It wasn't necessarily somebody saying, you should definitely go do this. It was more of like learning, and then as I'm learning and somebody saying, why don't you try this, I discovered a passion. So I finished my grad school because my dad was on my shoulder, saying, you have to get the degree. J.P. Morgan offered me a full-time job. They essentially taught me how to code, and I am now essentially this chief operating officer for our entire global technology division. So I'm one of 15 senior technologists who oversee $9.3 billion in spend in technology at J.P. Morgan. So, and by the way, I don't think that I'm superior in all ways. It's more of I was very fortunate to take that opportunity to really find my passion in a way that I never thought I would find. And definitely not a traditional career path along my education. It's just more or less trial and error, and really enjoy what I do.
Thank you. So one of the things that I have learned in my work is that we're all very good eventually at getting clear about what we like, what our interests or our passions are. But it often takes other people to tell us what our strengths are. In fact, there's a famous quote by Peter Drucker, most people think they know what they're good at. They don't. It takes somebody else to tell us what they're good at. And both of these ladies have given us examples of where others have come to them and said, I recognize the strength in you, and I think you might want to try something. And so I'd like to ask them, what was it that you think that you did that made that welcome?
Oh, good. I thought you were going to start with Gina. made it welcome when the developer said, hey, I think you should try mm-hmm. that. I think one of the things that J.P. Morgan has in its culture, and it's one of the reasons I stayed, is that we're very collaborative. So I think part of it's just the nature of the work. We work in a team environment, and I'd like to think, and people have told me that I am a fairly good collaborator, so I think it was also that I was open to working with that individual and looking over their shoulder, and they were open and vice versa to let me do that. So there's definitely a team dynamic that no matter where you work, I think these days, there's no longer that job of sitting in the corner banging away at the keyboard no matter what it is. You have to work with other people. And having that collaborative team environment, that constructive team environment, can open you up to a lot more opportunities from a learning perspective, from a people perspective. And in this case, I think he was the gentleman I'm thinking of, was just very willing to look at somebody who was a great team player and say, why don't I teach you how to do this? And quite frankly, even today, and definitely back then, there weren't enough people in technology. Forget about female. There weren't enough people in technology. So I think he saw the aptitude of somebody who could actually help him do his job. But I think the starting point is absolutely being a good team player and being somebody who's open to learning new things as well as open to working on a team.
Okay, mine doesn't feel quite as noble, but I will tell you, when the administrator first said this to me, my first two immediate thoughts were,
thank God at least I'm going to get another chance and it's not going to be just you're fired, you're terminated. So I was relieved. And secondly, some of what he was saying, and I think what, you know, again, what made him think that is it was going to give me a lot of opportunity to interact with other people and talk about things and communicate things and perhaps help design business strategies around things. And that really fascinated me. It always had, in a way. I'd been very much a joiner and a leader in high school and college and, you know, leading projects and things like that. So I thought, this is a chance to do this. And it does feel like it's a combination of doing that problem solving and leading people, but it also gives me a chance to kind of maybe like be back in front of the room. And I loved being in front of the room. I still love being in front of the room. So it just felt like it like fit. And again, I was not sure of some of the business aspects. I didn't have a degree in finance. I didn't have a background in finance or business process, but it was other things that felt very natural to me for other reasons. And he was giving me a chance to kind of pull those together in a field that I wouldn't have thought of on my own.
Is there any advice that either one of you would give to all of us in the room if we're not clear about what we're interested in or we're not clear about what our strengths are?
I will say a couple of things. I mean, there's sort of the obvious answers that talk to a lot of people that are doing things that seem interesting to you. Even if you don't think it necessarily applies to you, understand what they're doing and why they're doing it. You may find a nugget in there that actually does apply to you. So to my experience, that whole business piece, the piece that immediately attracted me was being in front of people and solving problems and pulling together, and then the bigger piece got there. So talk to a lot of people that do things and don't underestimate that there could be a nugget in there for you. And then the other thing that I kind of always tell, and I have a lot of young adults, great young adults, many of whom are here today, that work on my team, and I just always say, don't stop taking the next opportunity. I mean, even if it doesn't feel like the natural fit, even if technology doesn't feel like the natural fit, don't not take it. Give it a try. If it doesn't work, you're early in your career, you can try something else. But try that next opportunity. Take that sort of pivot if it's something that is offered to you and give it a shot. I think it might be a very surprising outcome.
Building on that point, have you actually gone after roles yourself since that first episode that you didn't feel quite comfortable with?
Yes. I don't know if I went after it, but when I was assigned those responsibilities around the managed care contracting, I was frankly terrified. So, to the point that I almost walked in and said, I can't take this responsibility. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't think I can do it. I don't think I can be successful at it. I stopped myself because I just thought, you know, I don't even know that this is an option, and maybe I better learn it because maybe this is more than a phase. Maybe this is going to be the next iteration of what I do, and I better try to learn another skill set. So it was certainly, I mean, I was happy doing the more traditional marketing and PR things. This was one of those kind of pivots for a while that I felt very uncomfortable with. And full disclosure, for 6 months, I had that go to bed every night and wake up going, I don't know what the heck I'm doing today. I don't know how to do this job. And they're going to find out and they are going to fire me. And it's all going to turn out badly. It didn't. It worked out. But it was a pretty scary 6 months. And 6 months where I found myself asking the same questions over and over again of people trying to understand what I was doing. So definitely some risk involved there.
Okay. Did you?
Take a risk.
Risk ahead.
Yeah, so I definitely, so early in my career, I was heading in technology, straight technical path. And so when you get to be a developer and a DBA, a database administrator, and then the next step in that straight technical path at the time that I took it was being an architect. And at the time, so I said, okay, let me go try being an architect. And at the time, the architects in our firm were, and they're very different now, so all due respect for all the architects we have, but at the time, they were very research and white paper oriented. So it was like you do kind of sit with a couple architects and you theorize about a bunch of things, and that was just not my personality. So I did that for about 6 to 9 months. The history gets hazier as you get older, but I didn't like it. I might have been good, like I was not super worried about getting fired, but I definitely wasn't going to be successful in that job long term. So I raised my hand and I went to talk to my boss, and at the time we had an opportunity to go more on the project management side, and so let me try that instead. But I tell that story, and oftentimes, similar to what I think, Sarah, you were talking about, people say, oh, wow, was that a mistake, right? And I'm like, you know, in some ways you could say, okay, it was a mistake to go be an architect. I really look at it like, no, I actually think that was a fantastic opportunity for me to learn what I didn't like to do. Mm-hmm. And many times knowing what you don't like to do is just as powerful and maybe even more powerful than knowing exactly what you want to do. So I wouldn't, if I go back, I would do it all over again. I would still take that job. I would know now what I did then around, that's not really what my bailiwick is. Let me go in this direction. So I very much agree with what Gina was saying, too. Like, the best way to find these things out is absolutely asking people for feedback. That notion of feedback is so important. But also just try some different things. I talk to a lot of, as Sarah's mentioning, I do a lot with the universities, and I talk to a lot of folks that are still students in school, and the first thing I tell them is, like, I don't care how old you are, freshman, sophomore, go get internships. And by the way, while I love for all of them to work at JPMorgan Chase, go work at different places. So when I was interning at JPMorgan, I also, for my degree, had to intern at a nonprofit agency. And it was very clear to me that that wasn't the type of environment for me, that JPMorgan and the type of work that I was doing was more for me. It's not the same for everybody else, but that experience and that diversity of trying different things is really important, even if it's a lesson in what you don't want to do.
And that cultural fit is an important lesson, which you have an interesting story about.
Yes. And now I'm talking about it really publicly, so we're gonna not tell it back at work so much. But most people know. So when I first started at my full-time position at JPMorgan, literally the day before I was supposed to start, they sold the division that I was working in. And they said, okay, great, so we need you to stay through the sale of that division, so we're gonna give you this, you know, great retention bonus at the end of it for 2 years. And, you know, at the end of that, by the way, so I was fresh out of school, so I'm young, and I was getting married at the time, and so that retention bonus was like, you know, all the money I'd ever seen in the whole world. So I did that, and then I said, you know, I was in the market looking for another job, and it was also a very hot time in the technology industry, and so I got another job working, doing my same job as a technologist at a healthcare company. So for me, if you know my background now, it was like ideal state. So I found my love of technology. I'm going to now marry it with my love of healthcare. So I started working at that company. You literally could have written my job profile at JPMorgan and at this new company, whited out the company name. It was the exact same job. So I start working there, and I'm doing the same thing, but a very different culture. People were really nice, so it's not like I was working for a giant jerk, which we know can ruin everybody's career. But people were extremely nice, it was the exact same thing, but the culture was one that if they selected a date to deploy that system, you were darn well gonna deploy that system on that date, even if the system was blowing up and throwing errors and, quite frankly, mismanaging patient data. And it felt like crap going home every night. It really did. There was I couldn't look myself in the mirror of this is people's patient data. And it's not it wasn't the brain surgery, but it was significant things that we were doing with these systems. And for me, that culture of not having as high a degree of a quality focus in that culture was not something that was going to work for me. And perfectly nice people, lots of good career trajectory, but it just didn't fit with my core values. And so, frankly, JPMorgan called me less than 3 months later and said, would you come back? And I was like, I'll be there Monday. But I think the biggest lesson was really around, we all think, you know, when you look at looking for new jobs, you're looking at the skills that you're going to gain on the piece of paper or the money or the title. And what we really, I think, underestimate is how important it is for us to work in an organization, even when we say organization, in a team that really aligns with your core values. And, you know, be it you want to learn or you do want to get things out on time, it has to align. And nobody can tell you what those are until you actually experience it yourself. But as you're looking, if you're at that point where you're looking at other careers or other job opportunities, make sure that culture, that company culture, is really, really close to the top of that list, because it can make you extremely miserable.
Do you have any tips for assessing that ahead of time?
You know, it sounds like, and again, I've self-disclosed, I'm an introvert, right? So the biggest thing is you definitely do your homework, and sometimes your best bit of homework is find other people that work in that organization. So at JPMorgan, it's a huge company. It's 350,000 people, including our consultants. So when I go to take a job, even internally at JPMorgan, I spend a fair amount of time talking to the folks that I may know, or just even blindly looking people up on the phone book in that organization and having a conversation, right? What's it like? And you can't actually say what's your culture necessarily. You can, but you really the more important thing is you talk about, you know, some of the questions that you ask around, okay, what's, you know, what's the day-to-day like work for you? It's not the hours that you're interested in. You're interested in the interaction that you'll have with the team, the interaction with the boss, things of that nature that you're going to learn in that environment, that you collaborate in that environment. So whatever your core values are, you actually go and ask those questions to folks, or you do your research on the web if it's a new company. But that research and reaching out and understanding that piece of it through the people, I think, is the best way, is how you get a sense of the culture.
Do you have any tips for culture assessment?
I do. I mean, and they're very similar to what Courtney shared. Only I'll take mine and kind of flip it a little bit. I was in an organization that, in the early years, the culture seemed very fine. It was very energetic, and we were a little bit of a cowboy organization doing something that no one else had done. And it felt like a great culture. It was very challenging. It helped me learn how to make decisions quickly. And they seemed like all the good decisions, all the right decisions. About 6 years into it, I began to see things that were starting to bother me at the very, very top. And I was pretty close to the top, but at the very, very top, there was behaviors that didn't feel right to me. A lot of very ostentatious spending of money, and that didn't feel exactly right. And again, I've disclosed that I'm not a finance person, but I began to look at the numbers we were reporting, and I would be involved in doing a lot of that, and I could tell there were some things that were not right. And by this point, I'm doing very well. I'm one of the few senior women in the organization. I'm making a lot of money, and I'm the primary breadwinner in my family, so this was important. I had to make a decision about whether I could stay at that company. I couldn't define exactly what was wrong, but that cultural thing of they were going to win at all costs, and it turns out they were winning at the cost of lying to Wall Street and to all their investors about the finances. And I didn't know exactly that. I just knew that 2 and 2 were not equaling 4, and I just I had to go. So I went home, told my family that I felt like I had to leave my job, and I was sharing this story yesterday with some people, and I had my kids were like late middle school, early high school, and they were like, "What? You're going to quit your job? Because we have a really nice life going right now. We have fun trips, and this is awesome. And you know, you're going to buy me a Honda and all this kind of stuff." And I said, "I'm sorry, but I really can't be here. This is not right. And you got to trust me. I'll find the next opportunity, but I got to go." So we finally got to peace as a family, and I went in and resigned. And I was very fortunate. I had done the networking that all of you hear about. It's real. It pays off, because I found another role very quickly, within about 3 months. 4.5 months after I left that company, the FBI invaded the headquarters, and 18 people went to prison. So I was not involved, but I could see things were not right, and it was not a culture or a company that I wanted to be a part of any longer. It's hard to leave when you've got like golden handcuffs, but trust your intuition and your gut on those things.
So we've talked about 3 aspects of getting clear about what you want. Are you interested in it, and how do you discover that? What are your strengths, and how other people can help you find that, and then assessing cultural fit. But there are a couple of other things that women in particular have challenges with when they're structuring their own career. One is, after they get clear about what they want, is asking for it. So would either of you have any advice to women on how to ask for what they want?
Oh, wow. Can't Courtney start with this
one? Sure. I can give you a male story if that helps.
Okay.
First of all, the best way is to recognize that you manage your career as much, if not more so, than your manager does. And I think oftentimes, especially when we're first starting our career, we think it's more of, okay, they will give me what I want because I'm doing a great job. They're just going to see I'm doing a great job, and then they'll promote me. And what I've seen and experienced myself, but also coaching actually a male in this case, is, you know, you really do have to ask for it. And so if you have that relationship with your manager, that's always, you sit down on more than one time a year to talk about your career, how you're doing, and what you want out of it, it creates a much more natural dynamic. So it's not like I must have this, right? It's a longer term, more natural discussion. So one is definitely making sure you can have that dialogue with your manager, and that you take that responsibility to own your career and do ask for things. So the story I'll tell is I was very close friends with a gentleman and somewhat of his unofficial mentor, and we were talking at lunch, second year in a row, we were talking at lunch right after promotions got announced, and he is fuming that some, you know, list of people got promoted and he didn't. And I was listening and I was sitting there, I'm like, you know, did you actually tell Bob you wanted to get promoted? And he's like, well, no, like, I'm doing great, I'm doing a great job, and Bob should know. And I'm like, you know, here, and at this point in my career, by the way, I'm now sitting in a manager seat too, and I'm like, you know, it's kind of hard to get somebody promoted. And so if you don't know that they want to get promoted, as a manager, you always want to do the right things, but you're busy, and if you think somebody's happy doing what they're doing, and they're not asking, and this person is over here, you're going to go ask, you're going to help the person who asked for it. So, I mean, nothing against Bob. I think he's a great guy, and he's probably a pretty good manager, but you owe it to him and yourself to tell Bob that's what you want. And sure enough, like, he went in there, and then the very next year, he got promoted. Right, but it was like this you really can't be sitting there thinking like the utopian view of I'm going to do great and people will just give it to me. It's hard, it's time consuming, and if somebody's not help managing their own career to tell you that's what they want, then it's really likely not going to happen. So definitely feel comfortable asking. And by the way, what's the worst thing that's going to happen? You sit down with your manager and you say, "Hey, I would like to get this promotion, or I'd like to try this opportunity." And they're never going to say, unless they're a horrible manager and they should be fired, they're never going to say flat out no, right? They may say no, you're not ready yet because of X, Y, Z things, let's work on those together, right? Which is, and by the way, they could also, 50% likely, that they say yes, right? So what's the downside? You get a yes or you get a no with a direction of where you can actually build to get that yes a little bit later. So just always have it. It's hard, and it definitely feels uncomfortable. I think especially for women, it feels uncomfortable. But it really is likely not to happen unless you put yourself out there.
And, you know, just a thought to add to that, because I was like, it's a great story. Something that I've coached a lot of people to do, and I have done a couple of times myself, although I think I could have done it better, so hopefully I coached others to do it better, is when you go in and you want to have that conversation, do it in the context of the impact you're going to make on the organization. So make it about yourself, but also make it about yourself and the impact you're going to have on the organization. Every good manager and executive needs to hear that. We're constantly being challenged with how to make our organization better. And if we're looking at you and we're hearing from you and saying, if you allow me to take on these additional responsibilities, if you give me this promotion or this level, this is the impact that I believe that I can make on the organization. That speaks to a lot of things. It speaks to your confidence in yourself. It speaks to your respect for the organization and wanting the organization to be successful. And it actually speaks to the manager saying, because every manager needs to be successful too, and a lot of our success is measured in what our teams are able to accomplish. So when you frame it that way, I think it gives you a place to stand on when you're in the room, and it also makes that manager feel like they're doing the right thing for the company.
You know, I'll add to that too. One of the things that I think we're also challenged with as women is we don't often feel comfortable talking about our successes, right? And short of me saying, oh, feel comfortable, you'll be great. The other thing I've learned myself, right, wrong, or indifferent, is, you know, I have, as a manager, I also have a certain responsibility to my team. And if I'm not promoting my team, and in some ways maybe looks like I'm promoting myself, I'm hurting them, right? So if you don't feel comfortable telling your manager, look at all the great things I'm doing, you can talk about, look at all the great things my team is doing. And that may feel more natural. And just recognizing you do have that responsibility, by virtue of that, you may be promoting yourself, but in a way that probably feels a little bit better if you are just starting that journey and feeling uncomfortable with it.
So I'm sure that some of you have questions for these ladies if you want to go to the microphones. I have one more question that I want to ask them, and that has to do with how one keeps her self-confidence up while she's going through a big change like this. Which, and I will let you decide.
You need a rock, paper, scissors?
No, we could. I'll start and we can just maybe trade back and forth. For me, keeping your self-confidence up really goes to actually remembering everything else that you're good at in life. We're not all about that one thing, and in my career has been very important to me, and I won't pretend it hasn't been, but there are other things in my life that gave me confidence. I mentioned my interest in music and my love of performing. That was a real confidence both builder for me in that moment, and also going forward, it gave me a frame of reference that I wasn't actually going to live and die by that one decision in that one moment, but I had a framework of things. I'm a very friendly person. I make friends very easily. I get a lot of confidence from that, and that becomes a very good support around me. So for me, that self-confidence really comes from all of who you are, as opposed to that one moment in time for that one job opportunity or that next step. And you want to kind of keep that tape playing in your head when you're in there looking for those opportunities and making your case.
I completely agree. And it is those, when you go through something tough in your personal life, you end up saying, okay, but I'm good in this area, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. I have a 15-year-old daughter, and she is great in so many ways, except when she's rolling her eyes at her mother, which I'm told is very normal for 15. But she went out for the volleyball team this year, and she didn't make it. And it was like heartbreaking as your mom. You want to call the coach and be like, what is wrong with you? But basically what I realized through that exercise, one, it was perfectly, it's a life lesson that, you know, lots of people, my friend who I was telling you about before went to college on a soccer scholarship, and he told me, he's like, I got cut from teams too, so like it's part of life. But most importantly, that wasn't the only thing in her life. And so if, you know, had that been the only thing, and then she didn't focus on school, and she didn't also have band, and didn't also have a great set of friends, that could have been devastating. And just watching a teenager go through, that's very much true of the whole life. You have to be a whole person. You can't make it all about your job or all about home, and all of, you have to have that diversity to really help you through the bumps. And then I also think there's very much an aspect of just making sure that you give yourself a bit of a break when things happen and say, like, hey, it's okay. And as far as the confidence as well, like, I actually went to an incredible training program up in Massachusetts a number of years ago. And one of the things they say very much that we do as women, we tend to focus on the negative. Of like, you get your, have you guys all heard 3+, 3-, right? Who here, like, freaks out about the 3- and, like, puts together this huge action plan, right? Like, most of us, right? Very few of us look at those 3+ and say, well, how am I going to select my next job that's going to create these unique opportunities and show my strength in the best way possible? So, like, give yourselves a break on those 3-. Doesn't mean, you know, if somebody's saying you're really terrible at this and it's critical to your next job, you don't focus on it, but you focus more on the strengths and what makes you unique and what are the things that are really going to take you to the next level. And that's really important. And then the really practical one is I'm a female in technology, and still to this day, by the way, if you want to go in technology and you're not and you're female, come see me, because there's not enough of us. But I sit at a table 90% of the time with like maybe one other female if I'm lucky, right? So, and when I get in the room and I first started taking on these management jobs and I walk in the room and there's a bunch of men sitting around the table and me, there is that like notion of, oh my God, why am I here? Like, am I the token? And there's also this notion, by the way, if I say something bad, I'm not representing every woman in the whole world. And you're just sitting there like, I can't say it. And maybe I just won't say anything, because then it's better than not saying anything really stupid. But ultimately, I have this like little person, and sometimes I think it's my dad, who was always like the big, like, never made a difference between my brother and I about what we could do. Just standing there saying, you know, you're in the room not because you're a charity case. You're in the room because they expect you to be there and offer something, and you deserve to be there. And it sounds really hokey, like something out of Bugs Bunny or something, but you really have to have that, you know, if you're focusing on your strengths, it becomes a lot easier. But also recognize, like, there's very few companies in this world that are doing things that, like, as a charity. They're doing it because they expect things from you, and they think you can be there, and you better darn well contribute and not let down the entire women's race.
Well, while we're not letting down women, I will just add this, and this really will sound hokey, and it'll sound like everything that you ever were taught as a child, but it's actually very true. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Take time and invest in other people. If you see a colleague also struggling through this, take time to talk to them. You're going to help them, but I guarantee you're going to benefit yourself. You're going to find a lot of residents that you might not have expected, and that has actually, and I probably should have brought this up earlier, because that's had probably as big an impact on me as anything. Just those people, my peers or otherwise, who just would want to talk about maybe their situation, and I would talk, or I would talk to them about mine, and the resonance we would find does give you confidence that while you are representing the entire female race, you're doing it with a lot of other females around you going through the same thing. So just don't be afraid to share.
We have a question in the audience.
Good afternoon, ladies. Thank you so much for sharing your stories and for inspiring us all. My question for you each is what do you do when you know what your strengths are and you know what your passions are, and yet you still find a challenge in finding a role that will allow you to pursue those things?
Go ahead.
Yeah. It's a great question. And that's the like 30 second. One of them is, you know, make sure that you, as I said before, you have that open dialogue with your manager about that, and be a bit patient. Sometimes they're not always available, but sometimes you can, you know, if you're patient and you've articulated what you want, it will come to you over time. Or also, and then that's one aspect. The other aspect is, you know, don't be afraid to also take on opportunities that may not check all those boxes, but check some of them, and will give you a rich experience that you may learn something from that you didn't expect. So I mean, it's all about, for me, it's like just try different things too, but absolutely make sure it checks some of the boxes, by the way, but it may not check all of them.
And just to add on to that, sometimes you can get some of that by doing it like in a volunteer role or in a role outside of your actual job. You can continue to hone those skills and make them visible to somebody else, and they will come back around and create the opportunity for you. I have a colleague, she happens to be sitting in the audience, who had a passion for better understanding the customer, but there wasn't really a role like that in our company. She just pursued it anyway, did some things on her own time, kind of like forced the company to maybe give her some consulting hours to go and do it. It's now become a thing. It's a real thing, and she's very involved in leading it, but it wasn't a thing when she started. So sometimes you have to get creative. Sometimes you have to find a way to introduce it into the organization before they can build it with you.
All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hi.
Hello.
So my name is Shelley. I am 23, and I've been at my first job for about, 10 months or so. I just graduated college last year, and so I'm obviously still trying to find my strengths and my weaknesses and what I want, and basically everything you guys have been talking about for the past 45 minutes. So I started at this startup that's a production company, and I have zero experience in production, and basically the only reason I got this job is because the owner, who is a woman and sent me here, which she is amazing, we just clicked and we liked each other, and she's like, yeah, come work for me. I'm like, okay. So it's amazing because in the startup I've been able to really, I've been quote unquote promoted about, I don't know, 5 times in the past 10 months. Just because there's something else I wanted to do. And so at first it started social media, and then it was all around communications once I went full time. And then my boss found my logistical strengths, so I went into operations, and now she sees my communication strengths. Now I'm kind of going into new business a little bit, which all that stuff I never thought I would ever do. But obviously in a startup, we're a small company, so there's no real physical promotions. There's not much of a ladder, especially in my position where it's all production and I'm just helping the president with the operation and that kind of thing. So I'm just wondering if, and I don't know if this is even a good question, but if I'm limiting myself because there are no physical promotions, or because I love my job right now and I love the people I work with, but you know, somewhere like JP Morgan or AmerisourceBergen, you'll have, 15 steps ahead of you that you could possibly take. So, I don't know. Yeah. That's my question.
So first, I would just tell you, with that kind of job enjoyment and that many promotions, maybe you should be up here talking instead of us. Because,
exactly.
I mean, that sounds pretty phenomenal. And honestly, I love the structure of the corporation I work in, but I'm also very cognizant, because we work with a lot of agencies and production companies in what we do. And our marketing and communications things, I think that is more like the organization that's going to be available to many of you in the future. So I would encourage you to not get too caught on the actual functional ladder. As long as you're stretching yourself and you're doing this much more than you were here in terms of what you've learned and what you produce, and remember what you're impacting, then you're creating your career ladder. You're creating your own promotional ladder, and what people are going to look at over time is this breadth and depth of your experience. They're probably not going to look at
how many steps. They're going to look at, oh my gosh, she can do all of these things, and she learned to do them all and did them well over this period of time. So I would, even though I work in a company that very much has those steps and ladders, I wouldn't tell you it defines you.
I would add to that. I think it sounds like, first of all, you're really happy and you're learning and you're growing. And don't worry about the title, right? Don't worry about it. As long as you're learning and growing, great. The minute you stop learning and growing, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But absolutely what Gina said, like any prospective employer is going to look at your experience and your aptitude and not worry about the title. For example, when Sarah says she's a managing director at Accenture, and I say my title at J.P. Morgan is a managing director too, they're very different things. Mm-hmm. And somebody else could be sitting here saying they're a vice president, and they could actually, in the corporate structure, be more senior than a managing director, depending. There's a lot of variability in what you're called. That learning and growing is the most important thing. The only other thing I will tell you is that, like, when you get to the point where you're not learning and growing, or, by the way, you know you're the smartest one in your company, or you've done everything, then it's time to move. Like, absolutely. There's definitely been people I've coached where I'm like, okay, you're 30 and you are the most senior technologist in your company, you got to get out, right? Not because it's a bad company, but because you know you're not learning and growing and it's time to go somewhere else. So it sounds like where you are right now sounds fantastic.
It does. Yeah. It doesn't
really. Stay there.
Thank you.
So any last minute advice that either of you would like to share?
It's, you know, just, and this is a little bit of an easy putt, but just, good for you for investing your time and your mind in doing this. I didn't do enough of this early on, and I wish I'd done more, and I'm thoroughly enjoying getting to do it in these last few years. So again, you are gonna learn from everybody in the room, whether it's learning from, you know, what they didn't say or did say, from talking to people in the hallway. You're gonna expand your opportunities. So yeah, the networking is great, but the learning's even better. Just never stop taking advantage of those opportunities.
The only other thing I would add to that is something Gina mentioned earlier, right? Like, take what you're learning today and go back and tell 2, 3, 6 other women, right? Because I'll tell this quick story about my bus stop, right? So every time we go to the bus stop, it's a massive fight getting my daughter in the car. There's cursing in the car, like the whole thing, right? And get to that, and then like she gets on the bus and I like start like almost crying, like, oh God, what if I'm going to New York today and the whole world ends, and then the last thing I said was, on the bus, like, and then like I talk to the other like parents at the bus stop, and I'm like, oh, I feel so bad. I've just like yelled at my daughter, and they're like, oh yeah, we did that too. And so it's that notion of, right, there's strength in numbers. There's camaraderie. There's confidence in having people behind you, even if they're not physically standing behind you. You're all part of it. So take what you've learned today and go back and share it with others and build that network of strong women to make it.
And have fun in the process. And with that, I think we can end.
Thank you.